This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Queen of Air and Darkness, The Dark Artifices, Book 3 by Cassandra Clare. Read by James Marsters.
For Sarah, she knows what she did. Lo, death has reared himself a throne in a strange city lying alone, far down within the dim west, where the good and the bad and the worst and the best have gone to their eternal rest. There, shrines and palaces and towers, time-eaten towers that tremble not, resemble nothing that is ours. Around, by lifting winds forgot, resignedly beneath the sky the melancholy waters lie. No rays from the holy heaven come down on the long night time of that town, but light from out the lurid sea streams up the turrets silently, gleams up the pinnacles far and free, up domes, up spires, up kingly halls, up fanes, up Babylon-like walls, up shadowy long-forgotten bowers of sculptured ivy and stone flowers, up many and many a marvelous shrine, whose wreathed friezes intertwine the viol, the violet, and the vine. Resignedly beneath the sky the melancholy waters lie. So blend the turrets and shadows there, that all seem pendulous in air, while from a proud tower in the town, death looks gigantically down. There, open fanes and gaping graves yawn level with the luminous waves, but not the riches there that lie in each idol's diamond eye, not the gaily jeweled dead tempt the waters from their bed. For no ripples curl, alas. Along that wilderness of glass, no swellings tell that winds may be upon some far-off, happier sea. No heavings hint that winds have been on seas less hideously serene. But lo, a stir is in the air. The wave, there is a movement there. As if the towers had thrust aside, in slightly sinking the dull tide, as if their tops had feebly given a void within the filmy heaven. The waves have now a redder glow. The hours are breathing faint and low, and when, amid no earthly moans, down, down that town shall settle hence, hell, rising from a thousand thrones, shall do it reverence. Edgar Allan Poe, City in the Sea. Part 1. Feel No Sorrow. In the land of faerie, as mortals feel no sorrow, neither can they feel joy. Faerie Proverb. Chapter 1. Death looks down. There was blood on the council dais, blood on the steps, blood on the walls and the floor and the shattered remnants of the mortal sword. Later, Emma would remember it as a sort of red mist. A piece of broken poetry kept going through her mind. Something about not being able to imagine people had so much blood in them. They said that shock cushioned great blows, but Emma didn't feel cushioned. She could see and hear everything. The council hall full of guards. The screaming. She tried to fight her way through to Julian. Guards surged up in front of her in a wave. She could hear more shouting.
Emma Carstairs shattered the mortal sword! She destroyed a mortal instrument! Arrest her!
She didn't care what they did to her. She had to get to Julian. He was still on the ground, with Livy in his arms, resisting all efforts by the guards to lift her dead body away from him.
Let me through, she said. I'm his Parabatai. Let me through!
Give me the sword. It was the consul's voice. Give me Cortana, Emma, and you can help Julian. She gasped and tasted blood in her mouth. Alec was up on the dais now, kneeling by his father's body. The floor of the hall was a mass of rushing figures. Among them, Emma glimpsed Mark, carrying an unconscious Tai out of the hall, shouldering other Nephilim aside as he went. He looked grimmer than she'd ever seen him. Kit was with him. Where was Drew? There, she was alone, on the ground. No, Diana was with her, holding her and weeping. And there was Helen, fighting to get to the dais. Emma took a step back and almost stumbled. The wood floor was slippery with blood. Consul Gia Penhallow was still in front of her, her thin hand held out for Cortana. Cortana. The sword was a part of Emma's family, had been part of her memory for as long as she could recall. She could still remember Julian laying it in her arms after her parents had died, how she'd held the sword to her as if it were a child, heedless of the deep cut the blade left on her arm. Gia was asking her to hand over a piece of herself. But Julian was there, alone, bowed in grief, soaked in blood. And he was more of herself than Cortana was. Emma surrendered the sword, feeling it yanked from her grip, her whole body tensed. She almost thought she could hear Cortana scream at being parted from her.
Go, Gia said.
Emma could hear other voices, including Horace Dearborn's, raised, demanding she be stopped, that the destruction of the mortal sword and the disappearance of Annabelle Blackthorn be answered for. Gia was snapping at the guards, telling them to escort everyone from the hall. Now was a time of grief, not a time for revenge. Annabelle would be found.
Go with dignity, Horace, or you'll be escorted out. Now is not the time.
Aline helping Drew and Diana to their feet, helping them walk from the room. Emma fell to her knees by Julian. The metallic smell of blood was everywhere. Livy was a crumpled shape in his arms, her skin the color of skimmed milk. He had stopped calling for her to come back and was rocking her as if she were a child, his chin against the top of her head.
Jules,
Emma whispered, but the word sat bitterly on her tongue. That was her childhood name for him, and he was an adult now, a grieving parent. Livy had not just been his sister. For years he had raised her as a daughter.
Julian?
She touched his cold cheek, then Livy's colder one.
Julian, love, please let me help you.
He raised his head slowly. He looked as if someone had flung a pail full of blood at him. It masked his chest, his throat, spattered his chin and cheeks.
Emma.
His voice was barely a whisper.
Emma. I drew so many Razzis.
But Livy had already been dead when she hit the wood of the dais. Before Julian even lifted her into his arms. No rune, no Razzi would have helped.
Jules.
Helen had finally forced her way past the guards. She flung herself down beside Emma and Julian, heedless of the blood. Emma watched numbly as Helen carefully removed the broken shard of the mortal sword from Livy's body and set it on the ground. It stained her hands with blood, her lips white with grief. She put her arms around Julian and Livy both, whispering soothing words. The room was emptying around them. Magnus had come in, walking very slowly and looking pale. A long row of silent brothers followed him. He ascended the dais, and Alec rose to his feet, flinging himself into Magnus's arms. They held each other wordlessly as four of the brothers knelt and lifted Robert Lightwood's body. His hands had been folded over his chest, his eyes carefully closed. Soft murmurs of Awe, Atque, Wale, Robert Lightwood echoed behind him as the brothers carried his body from the room. The consul moved toward them. There were guards with her. The silent brothers hovered behind them, like ghosts, a blur of parchment. "You have to let go of her, Jules," Helen said in her gentlest voice. "She has to be taken to the Silent City." Julian looked at Emma. His eyes were stark as winter skies, but she could read them. "Let him do it," Emma said. "He wants the last person to carry Livy to be him." Helen stroked her brother's hair and kissed his forehead before rising. She said, "Gia, please." The consul nodded. Julian got slowly to his feet, Livy cradled against him. He began to move toward the stairs that led down from the dais. Helen at his side and the silent brothers following. But as Emma rose too, Gia put a hand out to hold her back. "Only family, Emma," she said.
"I am family. Let me go with them. Let me go with Livy,"
Emma screamed silently, but she kept her mouth firmly closed. She couldn't add her own sadness to the existing horror. And the rules of the Silent City were unchangeable. The law is hard, but it is the law. The small procession was moving toward the doors. The cohort had gone, but there were still some guards and other shadow hunters in the room. A low chorus of "Hail and farewell, Livia Blackthorn," followed them. The consul turned, Cortana flashing in her hand, and went down the steps and over to Aline, who had been watching as Livy was carried away. Emma began to shiver all over. A shiver that started deep down in her bones. She had never felt so alone. Julian was going away from her, and the other Blackthorns seemed a million miles away, like distant stars. And she wanted her parents, with a painful intensity that was almost humiliating. And she wanted Jem, and she wanted Cortana back in her arms, and she wanted to forget Livy, bleeding and dying and crumpled like a broken doll, as the window of the council hall exploded and the broken crown took Annabelle. Had anyone else seen it but her? Emma. Arms went around her, familiar, gentle arms raising her to her feet. It was Christina, who must have waited through all the chaos for her, who had stayed stubbornly in the hall as the guards shouted for everyone to leave, stayed to remain by Emma's side.
"Emma, come with me. Don't stay here. I'll take care of you. I know where we can go, Emma. Corazoncita, come with me."
Emma let Christina help her to her feet. Magnus and Alec were coming over to them. Alec's face tight, his eyes reddened. The dais was smeared with blood. Emma stood with her hand clasped in Christina's and looked out over the hall, which seemed to her an entirely different place than it had when they had arrived hours ago. Maybe because the sun had been up then, she thought, dimly hearing Magnus and Alec talking to Christina about
taking Emma to the house that had been set aside for the Blackthorns. Maybe because the room had darkened, and the shadows were thick as paint in the corners. Or maybe because everything had changed now. Maybe because nothing at all would ever be the same again.
Drew?
Helen knocked gently on the closed door of the room.
Drew, can I talk to you?
At least she was fairly sure it was Drew's room. The canal house next to the consul's residence on Prince Water Street had been prepared for the Blackthorns before the meeting, since everyone had assumed they would spend several nights in Idris. Helen and Aline had been shown it earlier by Diana, and Helen had appreciated the light touch of Diana's loving hands everywhere. There were flowers in the kitchen, and rooms had names taped to the doors. The one with two narrow beds was for the twins. The one for Tavi, full of books and toys Diana had brought from her own home over the weapons shop. Helen had stopped in front of a small room with flowered wallpaper.
"For Drew, maybe," she said. "It's pretty."
Diana looked dubious.
"Oh, Drew isn't like that," she said. "Maybe if the wallpaper had bats on it or skeletons."
Helen had winced. Aline had taken her hand.
"Don't worry," she'd whispered. "You'll get to know them all again."
She'd kissed Helen's cheek.
"It'll be easy peasy." And maybe it would have been, Helen thought, staring at the door with the note that said Drusilla on it. Maybe if everything had gone well.
Grief's sharp agony flared up in her chest. She felt as she imagined a fish caught on a hook might feel, twisting and turning to get away from the spike of pain driven into its flesh. She remembered this pain from the death of her father, when only the thought that she had to take care of her family, had to look after the children, had gotten her through. She was trying to do the same now, but it was clear the children, if they could even really be called that, only Tavi was truly a child and he was at the Inquisitor's house, having thankfully missed the horror in the council hall, felt awkward around her, as if she were a stranger, which only made the pain pierce deeper in her chest. She wished Aline was with her, but Aline had gone to be with her parents for a few hours.
"Drew,"
Helen said again, knocking with more force.
"Please, let me in."
The door flew open and Helen jerked her hand back before she accidentally punched Drew in the shoulder. Her sister stood in front of her, glaring in her ill-fitting black meeting clothes, too tight in the waist and chest. Her eyes were so red-rimmed, it looked as if she'd smeared scarlet eyeshadow across her lids.
"I know you might want to be alone," said Helen, "but I need to know that you're
all right," Drew said, a little sharply. The implication was clear.
"How could I possibly be all right?" "Surviving."
Drew glanced away for a moment. Her lips pressed tightly together, trembled. Helen ached to grab her little sister and hug her, to cuddle Drew the way she had years ago when Drew was a stubborn toddler.
"I want to know how Ty is."
"He's asleep," said Helen. "The Silent Brothers gave him a sedative potion, and Mark's sitting with him. Do you want to sit with him too?"
"I..."
Drew hesitated, while Helen wished she could think of something comforting to say about Ty. She was terrified of what would happen when he woke up. He'd fainted in the council hall, and Mark had carried him to the brothers, who were already in the guard. They'd examined him in eerie silence and stated that physically he was healthy, but they would give him herbs that would keep him sleeping. That sometimes the mind knew when it needed to shut down to prepare itself to heal. Though Helen didn't know how a night of sleep or even a year of it would prepare Ty for losing his twin.
"I want Jules,"
Drew said finally. Is he here?
No, Helen said. He's still with Livy, in the Silent City. She wanted to say he'd be back any moment. Aline had said the ceremony of laying someone out in the city as a preparation for cremation was a short one, but she didn't want to say anything to Drew that would turn out not to be true. What about Emma?
Drew's voice was polite but clear.
I want people I know, not you.
Helen swallowed hard.
I'll go look for her, she said.
She had barely turned away from Drew's door when it shut behind her with a small but determined click. She blinked away tears and saw Mark standing in the hallway a few feet from her. He had come close so soundlessly that she hadn't heard him approach. He held a crumpled piece of paper in his hand that looked like a fire message.
Helen, he said. His voice was rough.
After all his years in the hunt, would he grieve as fairies grieved? He looked rumpled, weary. There were very human lines under his eyes, at the sides of his mouth.
Ty is not alone. Diana and Kit are with him, and he sleeps on. Besides, I needed to speak with you.
I have to get Emma, Helen said. Drew wants her. Her room is just there. We can certainly get her before we leave, Mark said, indicating the farther end of the corridor. The house was paneled in honey-colored wood, the witchlight lamps lighting it to warmth. On another day, it would have been a pretty place.
Leave? Helen said, puzzled.
Mark nodded.
I have had a message from Magnus and Alec at the Inquisitor's house. I must go and fetch Tabby and tell him our sister is dead.
Mark reached out a hand for her, his face twisting with pain.
Please, Helen, come with me.
When Diana was young, she had visited a museum in London where the star attraction was a sleeping beauty made of wax. Her skin was like pale tallow, and her chest rose and fell as she breathed with the help of a small motor implanted in her body. Something about Ty's stillness and pallor reminded her now of the wax girl. He lay partly covered with the blankets on his bed, his only movement his breath.
His hands were loose and open at his sides. Diana longed for nothing more than to see his fingers moving, playing with one of Julian's creations with a cord of his headphones. Is he gonna be all right?
Kit spoke in a half whisper. The room was papered in cheerful yellow, both twin beds covered in rag bedspreads. Kit could have sat on the empty bed that was meant to be Libby's, but he hadn't. He was crouched in a corner of the room, his back against the wall, his legs drawn up. He was staring at Ty. Diana put her hand to Ty's forehead. It was cool. She felt numb throughout her body.
He's fine, Kit, she said.
She tugged the blanket up over Ty. He stirred and murmured, shrugging it off. The windows were open. They'd thought the air might be better for Ty, but Diana crossed the room to close them now. Her mother had always been obsessed with the idea that the worst thing that could happen to someone was catching a chill, and apparently you never forget what your parents told you. Beyond the window, she could see the city, outlined in the early dusk and the rising moon. She thought of a figure on horseback, riding across that vast sky. She wondered if Gwyn knew of this afternoon's events, or if she would have to send him a message. And what would he do or say when he received it? He had come to her once before, when Livy, Ty, and Kit were in danger. But he had been called upon by Mark then. She still wasn't sure if he'd done it because he was genuinely fond of the children, or if he had simply been discharging a debt. She paused
hand on the window curtain. In truth, she knew little about Gwyn. As the leader of the Wild Hunt, he was almost more mythic than human. She wondered how emotions might be felt by those so powerful and old they had become part of myths and stories. How could he really care about any mortal's little life, given the scope of what he had experienced? And yet, he had held her and comforted her in her old bedroom when she had told him what she had only ever told Katerina and her parents before, and her parents were dead. He had been kind, hadn't he?
Stop it.
She turned back to the room. Now wasn't the time to think about Gwyn, even if some part of her hoped he would come and comfort her again. Not when Ty might wake up any moment into a world of new and terrible pain. Not when Kit was crouched against the wall as if he'd fetched up on some lonely beach after a disaster at sea. She was about to put her hand on Kit's shoulder when he looked up at her. There were no marks of tears on his face. He had been dry-eyed after his father's death, too, she recalled, when he had opened the door of the Institute for the first time and realized he was a shadow hunter. "Ty likes familiar things," said Kit. "He won't know where he is when he wakes up. We should make sure his bag is in here, and whatever stuff he brought from London." "It's over there." Diana pointed to where Ty's duffel had been placed under the bed that should have been Libby's. Without looking at her, Kit got to his feet and went over to it. He unzipped it and took out a book, a thick book, with old-fashioned page binding. Silently, he placed it on the bed just next to Ty's open left hand. And Diana caught a glimpse of the title embossed in gold across the cover and realized that even her numb heart could twinge with pain. The Return of Sherlock Holmes. The moon had begun to rise, and the demon towers of Alicante glowed in their light. It had been many years since Mark had been in Alicante. The Wild Hunt had flown over it, and he remembered seeing the land of Idris spread out below him as the others in the hunt whooped and howled, amused at flying over Nephilim land. But Mark's heart had always beaten faster at the sight of the Shadow Hunter homeland, the bright silver quarter of Lake Lynn, the green of Brosseland Forest, the stone manor houses of the countryside, and the glimmer of Alicante on its hill. And Kieran beside him, thoughtful, watching Mark, as Mark watched Idris. "My place, my people. My home," he'd thought. But it seemed different from ground level, more prosaic, filled with the smell of canal water in summer, streets illuminated by harsh witch light. It wasn't far to the Inquisitor's house, but they were walking slowly. It was several minutes before Helen spoke for the first time. "You saw our aunt and fairy," she said. "Neen, only Neen, right?" "She was in the Seely Court." Mark inclined his head, glad to have the silence broken. "How many sisters did our mother have?"
6 or 7, I think," said Helen. "Neen is the only one who is kind." "I thought you didn't know where Neen was."
"She never spoke of her location to me, but she has communicated with me on more than one occasion since I was sent to Wrangell Island," said Helen.
"I think she felt sympathy in her heart for me."
"She helped hide us and heal Kieran," said Mark. "She spoke to me of our fairy names." He looked around. They had reached the Inquisitor's house, the biggest on this stretch of pavement, with balconies out over the canal.
"I never thought I would come back here. Not to Alicante. Not as a shadow hunter."
Helen squeezed his shoulder and they walked up to the door together. She knocked and a harried-looking Simon Lewis opened the door. It had been years since Mark had seen him, and he looked older now.
His shoulders were broader, his brown hair longer, and there was stubble along his jaw. He gave Helen a lopsided smile. "The last time you and I were here, I was drunk and yelling up at Isabel's window." He turned to Mark. "And the last time I saw you, I was stuck in a cage in Ferry." Mark remembered. Simon looking up at him through the bars of the fey-wrought cage. Mark saying to him, "I am no fairy. I am Mark Blackthorne of the Los Angeles Institute. It doesn't matter what they say or what they do to me. I still remember who I am." "Yes," Mark said. "You told me of my brothers and sisters, of Helen's marriage. I was grateful." He swept a small bow out of habit and saw Helen look surprised. "I wish I could have told you more," Simon said in a more serious voice. "And I'm so sorry about Livy. We're grieving here, too." Simon swung the door open wider. Mark saw a grand entryway inside, with a large chandelier hanging from the ceiling. Off to the left was a family room, where Rafe, Max, and Tavi sat in front of an empty fireplace, playing with a small stack of toys. Isabel and Alec sat on the couch. She had her arms around his neck and was sobbing quietly against his chest. Low, hopeless sobs that struck an echo deep inside his own heart, a matching chord of loss. "Please tell Isabel and Alec we are sorry for the loss of their father," said Helen. "We did not mean to intrude. We're here for Octavian." At that moment, Magnus appeared from the entryway. He nodded at them and went over to the children, lifting Tavi up in his arms. Though Tavi was getting awfully big to be carried, Mark thought. But in many ways, Tavi was young for his age, as if early grief had kept him more childlike. As Magnus approached them, Helen began to lift her hands, but Tavi held out his arms to Mark. In some surprise, Mark took the burden of his little brother in his arms. Tavi squirmed around, tired but alert.
"What's happened?" he said. "Everyone's crying."
Magnus ran a hand through his hair. He looked extremely weary. "We haven't told him anything," he said. "We thought it was for you to do." Mark took a few steps back from the door, Helen following after him, so they stood in the lighted square of illumination from the entryway. He set Tavi down on the pavement. This was the way the fair folk broke bad news. Face to face. "Livy is gone, child," he said. Tavi looked confused.
"Gone where?"
"She has passed into the Shadowlands," said Mark. He was struggling for the words. Death in fairy was such a different thing than it was to humans. Tavi's blue-green blackthorn eyes were wide.
"Then we can rescue her," he said. "We can go after her, right? Like we got you back from Ferry. Like you went after Kieran."
Helen made a small noise.
"Oh, Octavian," she said.
"She is dead," Mark said helplessly, and saw Tavi wince away from the words. "Mortal lives are short and fragile in the face of eternity." Tavi's eyes filled with tears.
"Mark,"
Helen said, and knelt down on the ground, reaching her hands out to Tavi.
"She died so bravely," she said. "She was defending Julian and Emma, our sister. She was courageous."
The tears began to spill down Tavi's face.
"Where's Julian?" he said. "Where did he go?"
Helen dropped her hands. "He's with Livy in the Silent City. He'll be back soon. Let us take you back home, to the canal house."
"Home?"
Tavi said scornfully.
"Nothing here is home."
Mark was aware of Simon having come to stand beside him. God, poor kid, he said. Look, Mark. Octavian. It was Magnus's voice. He was standing in the doorway still, looking down at the small, tear-stained boy in front of him. There was exhaustion in his eyes, but also an immense compassion, the kind of compassion that came with great old age. He seemed as if he would have said more, but Rafe and Max had joined him. Silently, they filed down the steps and went over to Tavi. Rafe was nearly as tall as he was, though he was only 5. He reached to hug Tavi, and Max did too, and to Mark's surprise, Tavi seemed to relax slightly, allowing the embraces, nodding when Max said something to him in a quiet voice. Helen got to her feet, and Mark wondered if his face wore the same expression hers did, of pain and shame. Shame that they could not do more to comfort a younger brother who barely knew them. It's all right, Simon said. Look, you tried. We did not succeed, said Mark. You can't fix grief, said Simon. A rabbi told me that when my father died. The only thing that fixes grief is time, and the love of the people who care about you, and Tavi has that. He squeezed Mark's shoulder briefly. Take care of yourself, he said. Shelo tedu otsa'ar, Mark Blackthorne. What does that mean, said Mark. It's a blessing, said Simon. Something else the rabbi taught me. Let it be that you should know no further sorrow. Mark nodded in gratitude. Fairies knew the value of blessings freely given, but his chest felt heavy nonetheless. He could not imagine the sorrows of his family would be ending soon. Chapter 2. Melancholy Waters. Christina stood despairingly in the extremely clean kitchen of the Prince Water Street Canal House, and wished there was something she could tidy up. She'd washed dishes that didn't need washing. She'd mopped the floor and set and reset the table. She'd arranged flowers in a vase and then thrown them out and then retrieved them from the trash and arranged them again. She wanted to make the kitchen nice, the house pretty. But was anyone really going to care if the kitchen was nice and the house was pretty? She knew they wouldn't. But she had to do something. She wanted to be with Emma and comfort Emma, but Emma was with Drusilla, who had cried herself to sleep, holding Emma's hand. She wanted to be with Mark and comfort Mark, but he'd left with Helen, and she could hardly be anything but glad that at last he was getting to spend time with a sister he'd missed for so long. The front door rattled open, startling Christina into knocking a dish from the table. It fell to the floor and shattered. She was about to pick it up when she saw Julian come in, closing the door behind him. Locking runes were more common than keys in Idris. But he didn't reach for his steely, just looked sightlessly from the entryway to the stairs. Christina stood frozen. Julian looked like a ghost from a Shakespeare play. He clearly hadn't changed since the council hall. His shirt and jacket were stiff, with dried blood. She never knew quite how to talk to Julian anyway. She knew more about him than was comfortable, thanks to Emma. She knew he was desperately in love with her friend. It was obvious in the way he looked at Emma, spoke to her, in gestures as Tiny's handing her a dish across a table. She didn't know how everyone else didn't see it, too. She'd known other Parabatai, and they didn't look at each other like that. Having such personal information about someone was awkward at the best of times. This wasn't the best of times. Julian's expression was blank. He moved forward into the hall, and as he walked, his sister's dried blood flaked off his jacket and drifted to the floor. If she just stood still, Christina thought, he might not see her, and he might go upstairs, and they'd both be spared an awkward moment. But even as she thought it, the bleakness in his face tugged at her heart. She was in the doorway before she realized she'd moved. "Julian," she said quietly. He didn't seem startled. He turned to face her as slowly as an automaton winding down. "How are they?" he said. "How did you answer that?" "They're well taken care of," she said finally. "Helen has been here, and Diana, and Mark. Ty is still asleep," she said. She tugged nervously at her skirt. She'd changed all the clothes since the council hall, just to feel clean. For the first time, he met her eyes. His were shot through with red, though she didn't remember having seen him cry. Or maybe he had cried when he was holding Livy. She didn't want to remember that. "Emma," he said, "is she all right? You know, she would tell you." "She's with Drusilla, but I'm sure she'd like to see you." "But is she all right?" "No," Christina said. "How could she be all right?" He glanced toward the steps, as if he couldn't imagine the effort it would take to climb them. "Robert was going to help us," he said. "Emma and me. You know about us. I know that you do. That you know how we feel." Christina hesitated, stunned. She never thought Julian would mention any of this to her.
"Maybe the next Inquisitor..."
"I passed through the guard on my way back," Julian said. "They're already meeting. Most of the cohort and half the council, talking about who's going to be the next Inquisitor. I doubt it's going to be someone who will help us. Not after today. I should care," he said. "But right now, I don't." A door opened at the top of the steps, and light spilled onto the dark landing.
"Julian?" Emma called. "Julian, is that you?"
He straightened a little, unconsciously, at the sound of her voice.
"I'll be right there."
He didn't look at Christina as he went up the stairs, but he nodded to her, a quick gesture of acknowledgement. She heard his footsteps die away, his voice mingling with Emma's. She glanced back at the kitchen, the broken dish lay in the corner. She could sweep it up. It would be the more practical thing to do, and Christina had always thought of herself as practical. A moment later, she had thrown her gear jacket on over her clothes. Tucking several serif blades into her weapons belt, she slipped quietly out the door and into the streets of Alicante. Emma listened to the familiar sound of Julian coming up the stairs. The tread of his feet was like music she had always known. So familiar, it had almost stopped being music. Emma resisted calling out again. She was in Drew's room, and Drew had fallen asleep, worn out, still in the clothes she had worn to the council meeting. Emma heard Julian's step in the hall, and then the sound of a door opening and closing. Careful not to wake Drew, she slipped out of the room. She knew where Julian was without having to wonder. Down the hall a few doors was Ty's borrowed bedroom. Inside, the room was softly lit. Diana sat in an armchair by the head of Ty's bed, her face tight with grief and weariness. Kit was asleep, propped against the wall, his hands in his lap. Julian stood by Ty's bed, looking down, his hands at his sides. Ty slept without restlessness, a drugged sleep, hair dark against the white pillows. Still, even in sleep, he kept himself to the left side of the bed, as if leaving a space beside him open for Livy. "His cheeks are flushed," Julian was saying, "like he has a fever." "He doesn't," Diana said firmly. "He needs this, Jules. Sleep heals." Emma saw the open doubt on Julian's face. She knew what he was thinking. "Sleep didn't heal me when my mother died, or my father.
And it won't heal this either. It will always be a wound.
Diana glanced over at Emma. Drew, she said. Julian looked up at that, and his eyes met Emma's. She felt the pain in his gaze, like a blow to her chest. It was suddenly hard to breathe.
Asleep, she said, almost in a whisper. It took a little while, but she finally crashed.
I was in the Silent City, he said. We brought her there. I helped them lay her body out.
Diana reached up and put her hand on his arm.
Jules, she said quietly, you need to go and get yourself cleaned up and get some rest.
I should stay here, Julian said in a low voice. If Ty wakes up and I'm not here,
he won't, Diana said. The Silent Brothers are precise with their doses.
If he wakes up and you're standing here covered in Livy's blood, Julian, it won't help anything, Emma said. Diana looked at her, clearly surprised by the harshness of her words. But Julian blinked as if coming out of a dream. Emma held out her hand to him.
Come on, she said.
The sky was a mixture of dark blue and black, where storm clouds had gathered over the mountains in the distance. Fortunately, the way up to the guard was lit by witchlight torches. Christina slipped along beside the path, keeping to the shadows. The air held the ozone tang of an oncoming storm, making her think of the bitter penny tang of blood. As she reached the front doors of the guard, they opened and a group of Silent Brothers emerged. Their ivory robes seemed to glimmer with what looked like raindrops. Christina pressed herself back against the wall. She wasn't doing anything wrong. Any shadow hunter could come to the guard when they liked, but she instinctively didn't want to be seen. As the brothers passed close by her, she saw that it wasn't rain after all, sparkling on their robes, but a fine dusting of glass. They must have been in the council hall. She remembered the window smashing inward as Annabelle had disappeared. It had been a blur of noise, splintering light. Christina had been focused on the Blackthorns, on Emma, the look of devastation on her face, on Mark, his body hunched inward, as if he were absorbing the force of a physical blow. The inside of the guard was quiet. Head down, she walked rapidly down the corridors, following the sound of voices toward the hall. She veered aside to take the stairs up to the second floor seats, which jutted out over the rest of the room like a balcony in a theater. There was a crowd of Nephilim milling around on the dais below. Someone, the Silent Brothers, had cleared away the broken glass and blood. The window was back to normal.
Clear up the evidence all you want, Christina thought as she knelt down to peer over the railing of the balcony. It still happened.
She could see Horace Dearborn, seated on a high stool. He was a big, bony man. Not muscular, though his arms and neck were ropey with tendons. His daughter, Zara Dearborn, her hair in a neat braid around her head, her gear immaculate, stood behind him. She didn't resemble her father much, except perhaps in the tight anger of their expressions and in their passion for the cohort, a faction within the Clave, who believed in the primacy of Shadowhunters over Downworlders, even when it came to breaking the law. Crowded around them were other Shadowhunters, young and old. Christina recognized quite a few Centaurians. Manuel Casales Villalobos, Jessica Beausejour, and Samantha Larkspear among them, as well as many other Nephilim who had been carrying cohort signs at the meeting. There were quite a few, though, who, as far as she knew, were not members of the cohort. Like Laszlo Balog, the craggy head of the Budapest Institute, who had been one of the main architects of the Cold Peace and its punitive measures against downworlders. Josiane Pontmercy, she knew from the Marseille Institute.
Delaney Scarsbury taught at the academy. A few others she recognized as friends of her mother's, Trini Castell from the Barcelona conclave, and Luana Carvalho, who ran the institute in Sao Paulo, had both known her when she was a small girl. They were all council members. Christina said a silent prayer of thanks that her mother wasn't here, that she'd been too busy dealing with an outbreak of Halfus demons in the Alameda Central to attend, trusting Diego to represent her interests.
"There is no time to lose," Horace said. He exuded a sense of humorless intensity, just like his daughter. "We are here without an inquisitor, now at a critical time, when we are under threat from outside and inside the clave." He glanced around the room. "We hope that after today's events, those of you who have doubted our cause will come to be believers."
Christina felt cold inside. This was more than just a cohort meeting. This was the cohort recruiting, inside the empty council hall where Livy had died. She felt sick.
"What do you think you've learned exactly, Horace?" said a woman with an Australian accent. "Be clear with us, so we're all understanding the same thing."
He smirked a little.
"Andrea Sedgwick," he said. "You were in favor of the cold peace, if I recall correctly."
She looked pinched.
"I don't think much of Downworlders, but what happened here today?"
"We were attacked," said Dearborn. "Betrayed, attacked inside and out. I'm sure you saw what I saw, the sigil of the Unseelie Court."
Christina remembered. As Annabelle had disappeared, borne away through the shattered window of the hall, as if by unseen hands, a single image had flashed on the air. A broken crown. The crowd murmured their assent. Fear hung in the air like a miasma. And Dearborn clearly relished it, almost licking his lips as he gazed around the room.
"The Unseelie King, striking at the heart of our homeland. He sneers at the cold peace. He knows we are weak. He laughs at our inability to pass stricter laws, to do anything that would really control the Fae."
"No one can control the Fae," said Scarsbury.
"That's exactly the attitude that's weakened the clave all these years," snapped Zara. Her father smiled at her indulgently.
"My daughter is right," he said.
"The Fae have their weaknesses, like all downworlders. They were not created by God or by our angel. They have flaws, and we have never exploited them. Yet they exploit our mercy and laugh at us behind their hands."
"What are you suggesting?" said Trini. "A wall around Fairy?"
There was a bit of derisive laughter. Fairy existed everywhere and nowhere. It was another plane of existence. No one could wall it off. Horace narrowed his eyes.
"You laugh," he said, "but iron doors at all the entrances and exits of Fairy would do a great deal to prevent their incursions into our world."
"Is that the goal?"
Manuel spoke lazily, as if he didn't have much invested in the answer.
"Close off Fairy?"
"There's not only one goal, as you well know, boy," said Dearborn. Suddenly he smiled, as if something had just occurred to him.
"You know of the Blight, Manuel. Perhaps you should share your knowledge, since the Consul has not. Perhaps these good people should be aware of what happens when the doors between Fairy and the world are flung wide."
Holding her necklace, Christina seethed silently as Manuel described the patches of dead, blighted earth in Brosland Forest, the way they resisted Shadowhunter magic, the fact that the same blight seemed to exist in the Unseelie lands of Fairy.
"How did he know that?" Christina agonized silently. It had been what Kieran was going to tell the council, but he hadn't had the chance. How did Manuel know?
She was only grateful that Diego had done what she had asked him to do, and taken Kieran to the Skolomance. It was clear that there would be no safety for a full-blood fairy here.
The Unseelie King is creating a poison, and beginning to spread it to our world, one that will make Shadowhunters powerless against him. We must move now to show our strength, said Zara, cutting Manuel off before he was finished.
As you moved against Malcolm, said Laszlo.
There were titters, and Zara flushed. She had proudly claimed to have slain Malcolm Fade, a powerful warlock, though it had later turned out she had lied. Christina and the others had hoped the fact would discredit Zara, but now, after what had happened with Annabelle, Zara's lie had become little more than a joke. Dearborn rose to his feet.
That's not the issue now, Balog. The Blackthorns have fairy blood in their family. They brought a creature, a necromantic half-dead thing that slew our Inquisitor and filled the hall with blood and terror, into Alicante. Their sister was killed too, said Luana. We saw their grief. They did not plan what happened.
Christina could see the calculations going on inside Dearborn's head. He would have dearly liked to blame the Blackthorns and seen them all tossed into the Silent City prisons. But the spectacle of Julian holding Livy's body as she died was too raw and visceral for even the cohort to ignore.
They are victims, too, he said, of the fair folk prince they trusted, and possibly their own fairy kin. Perhaps they can be brought around to see a reasonable point of view. After all, they are shadow hunters, and that is what the cohort is about, protecting Shadow Hunters, protecting our own.
He laid a hand on Zara's shoulder.
When the mortal sword is restored, I am sure Zara will be happy to lay any doubts you have about her accomplishments to rest.
Zara flushed and nodded. Christina thought she looked guilty as sin, but the rest of the crowd had been distracted by the mention of the sword.
Immortal sword restored? Said Trini.
She was a deep believer in the angel and his power, as Christina's family was too. She looked anxious now, her thin hands working in her lap.
Our irreplaceable link to the angel Raziel?
You believe it will be returned to us?
It will be restored, Dearborn said smoothly. Gia will be meeting with the Iron Sisters tomorrow. As it was forged, so it can be reforged.
But it was forged in heaven, protested Trini. Not the adamant citadel.
And heaven let it break, said Dearborn.
And Christina suppressed a gasp. How could he claim such a brazen thing? Yet the others clearly trusted him.
Nothing can shatter the mortal sword, save Raziel's will.
He looked down upon us, and he saw that we were unworthy. He saw that we had turned away from his message, from our service to the angels, and were serving downworlders instead. He broke the sword to warn us. His eyes glittered with fanatic light. If we prove ourselves worthy again,
Raziel will allow the sword to be reforged. I have no doubts.
How dare he speak for Raziel? How dare he speak as if he were God?
Christina shook with fury. But the others seemed to be looking at him as if he offered them a light in darkness, as if he were their only hope.
And how do we prove ourselves worthy?
Said Balog in a more somber voice.
We must remember that shadow hunters were chosen, said Horace. We must remember that we have a mandate. We stand first in the face of evil, and therefore we come first. Let downworlders look to their own. If we work together, with strong leadership.
But we don't have strong leadership, said Jessica Beauséjour,
one of Zara's Centaurian friends. We have Gia Penhallow, and she is tainted by her daughter's association with fairies and half-bloods.
There was a gasp and a titter. All eyes turned toward Horace, but he only shook his head.
I will not utter a word against our consul, he said primly.
more murmurs. Clearly Horace's pretense of loyalty had won him some support. Christina tried not to grind her teeth. Her loyalty to her family is understandable, even if it may have blinded her, said Horace. What matters now is the laws the Clave passes. We must enforce strict regulations on downworlders, the strictest of all on the fair folk, though there is nothing fair about them.
That won't stop the Unseelie King, said Jessica, though Christina got the feeling she didn't so much doubt Horace as desire to prompt him to go further.
The issue is preventing fairies and other downworlders from joining the king's cause, said Horace. That is why they need to be observed, and if necessary, incarcerated before they have a chance to betray us.
Incarcerated? Trini echoed. But how?
Oh, there are several ways, said Horace. Wrangel Island, for instance, could hold a host of downworlders. The important thing is that we begin with control. Enforcement of the accords. Registration of each downworlder. Their name and location. We would start with the fairies, of course. There was a buzz of approval. We will, of course, need a strong inquisitor to pass and enforce those laws, said Horace.
Then let it be you, cried Trini. We have lost a mortal sword and an inquisitor tonight. Let us at least replace one. We have a quorum. Enough shadow hunters are here to put Horace forward for the inquisitor's position. We can hold a vote tomorrow morning. Who is with me?
A chant of Dearborn! Dearborn! Filled the room. Christina hung on to the railing of the balcony, her ears ringing. This couldn't happen. It couldn't. Trini wasn't like that. Her mother's friends weren't like that. This couldn't be the real face of the council. She scrambled to her feet, unable to stand another second of it, and bolted from the gallery. Emma's room was small and painted an incongruously bright shade of yellow. A white-painted four-poster bed dominated the space. Emma tugged Julian toward it, sitting him down gently, and went to bolt the door.
Why are you locking it?
Julian raised his head. It was the first thing he'd said since they'd left Ty's room.
You need some privacy, Julian. She turned toward him. God, the way he looked broke her heart.
Blood freckled his skin, darkened his stiff clothes, had dried in patches on his boots. Livy's blood. Emma wished she had been closer to Livy in those last moments, paid more attention to her, rather than worrying about the cohort, about Manuel and Zara and Jessica, about Robert Lightwood and exile, about her own broken, messed up heart. She wished she had held Livy one more time, marveling how tall and grown up she was, how she had changed from the chubby toddler Emma recalled in her own earliest memories.
Don't, Julian said roughly.
Emma came closer to him. She couldn't stop herself. He had to look up to meet her eyes.
Don't do what?
Blame yourself, he said. I can feel you thinking about how you should have done something different. I can't let those kind of thoughts in, or I'll go to pieces.
He was sitting on the very edge of the bed, as if he couldn't bear the thought of lying down.
Very gently, Emma touched his face, sliding the palm of her hand across his jaw. He shuddered and caught her wrist hard. Emma, he said, and for one of the first times in her life, she couldn't read his voice. It was low and dark, rough without being angry, wanting something, but she didn't know what.
What can I do? She breathed. What can I do? I'm your parabatai, Julian. I need to help you.
He was still holding her wrist. His pupils were wide discs, turning the blue-green of his irises into halos.
I make plans,
one step at a time, he said. Whenever things seem overwhelming, I ask myself what problem needs to be solved first. When that's solved, the next one. But I can't even begin here. She wrapped her hand around his wrist. Julian, she said, I am your warrior partner. Listen to me now. This is the first step. Get up.
He narrowed his eyes at her for a moment, then obliged by rising to his feet. They were standing close together. She could feel the solidity and warmth of him. She pushed his jacket off his shoulders, then reached up and gripped the front of his shirt. It had a texture like oilcloth now, tacky with blood. She pulled at it and tore it open, leaving it hanging from his arms. Julian's eyes widened, but he made no move to stop her. She ripped away the shirt and tossed it to the ground. She bent down and yanked off his bloodied boots. When she rose up, he was looking at her with both eyebrows raised. You're really gonna rip my pants off? He said. They have her blood on them, she said, almost choking on the words. She touched his chest, felt him draw in a breath. She imagined she could feel the jagged edges of his heart beneath the muscle. There was blood on his skin, too. Patches of it had dried on his neck, his shoulder, the places where he had held Libby close against him. You need to shower, she said. I'll wait for you. He touched her jaw lightly with the tips of his fingers. Emma, he said, we both need to be clean. He turned and went into the bathroom, leaving the door wide open. After a moment, she followed. He had left the rest of his clothes in a pile on the floor. He was standing in the shower in just his underwear, letting the water run down over his face, his hair. Swallowing hard, Emma stripped down to her panties and camisole and stepped in after him. The water was scalding hot, filling the small stone space with steam. He stood, unmoving under the spray, letting it streak his skin with pale scarlet. Emma reached around him and turned the temperature down. He watched her, wordless, as she took up a bar of soap and lathered it between her hands. When she put her soapy hands on his body, he inhaled sharply as if hurt, but he didn't move even an inch. She scrubbed at his skin, almost digging her fingers in as she scraped at the blood. The water ran pinkish red into the drain. The soap had a strong smell of lemon. His body was hard under her touch, scarred and muscled. Not a young boy's body at all. Not anymore. When had he changed? She couldn't remember the day, the hour, the moment. He bent his head as she worked the lather into his hair, stroking her fingers through the curls. When she was done, she tilted back his head, let the water run over both of them until it ran clear. She was soaked to the skin, her camisole sticking to her. She reached around Julian to turn the water off and felt him turn his head into her neck, his lips against her cheek. She froze. The shower had stopped running, but steam rose around them. Julian's chest was rising and falling fast, as if he were close to collapsing after a race. Dry sobs, she realized. He didn't cry. She couldn't remember the last time she'd seen him cry. He needed the release of tears, she thought, but he'd forgotten the mechanisms of weeping after so many years of holding back. She put her arms around him. It's all right, she said. His skin was hot against hers. She swallowed the salt of her own tears. Julian. He drew back as she raised her head, and their lips brushed. It was instant, desperate, more like a tumble over a cliff's edge than anything else. Their mouths collided, teeth and tongues and heat, jolts shuddering through Emma at the contact. Emma, he sounded stunned,
his hands knotting in the soaked material of her camisole.
Can I?
She nodded, feeling the muscles in his arms tighten as he swung her up into his arms. She shut her eyes, clutching at him, his shoulders, his hair, her hands slippery with water, as he carried her into the bedroom, tumbling her onto the bed. A second later he was above her, braced on his elbows, his mouth devouring hers feverishly. Every movement was fierce, frantic, and Emma knew. These were the tears he couldn't cry, the words of grief he couldn't speak. This was the relief he could only allow himself like this, in the annihilation of shared desire. Frantic gestures rid them of their wet garments. She and Julian were skin to skin now. She was holding him against her body, her heart. His hand slid down, shaking fingers, dancing across her hip bone. Let me. She knew what he wanted to say. Let me please you. Let me make you feel good first. But that wasn't what she wanted, not now. Come closer, she whispered. Closer. Her hands curved over the wings of his shoulder blades. He kissed her throat, her collarbones. She felt him flinch, hard, and whispered, What? He had already drawn away from her. Sitting up, he reached for his clothes, pulling them on with shaking hands. We can't, he said, his voice muffled. Emma, we can't. All right, but Julian... She struggled into a sitting position, pulling the blanket up over herself. You don't have to go. He leaned over the edge of the bed to grab his torn and bloodied shirt. He looked at her with a sort of wildness. I do, he said. I really do. Julian, don't. But he was already up, retrieving the rest of his clothes, yanking them on while she stared. He was gone, without putting his boots on, almost slamming the door behind him. Emma stared into the darkness, as stunned and disoriented as if she had fallen from a great height. Ty woke up suddenly, like someone drowning, exploding through the surface of water, gasping for air. The noise snapped Kit out of his doze. He'd been fitfully sleeping, dreaming about his father, walking around the shadow market with a massive wound across his stomach that seeped blood. This is how it is, Kit, he had been saying. This is life with the Nephilim. Still half asleep, Kit pushed himself up the wall with one hand. Ty was a motionless shadow on the bed. Diana was no longer there. She was probably catching a few moments of sleep in her own room. He was alone with Ty. It came to him how completely unprepared he was for all of this. For Livy's death, yes. Though he'd seen his own father die, and he knew there were still aspects of that loss he hadn't faced. Never having coped with that loss, how could he cope with this one? And given that he'd never known how to help anyone else, how to offer normal kinds of comfort, how could he help Ty? He wanted to shout for Julian, but something told him not to, that the shouting might alarm Ty. As Kit's eyes adjusted, he could see the other boy more clearly. Ty looked disconnected, might be the best word for it, as if he hadn't quite alighted back on Earth. His soft black hair seemed crumpled like dark linen, and there were shadows under his eyes. Jules, he said, his voice low. Kit pushed himself fully upright, his heart beating unevenly. It's me, he said. Kit. He had braced himself for Ty's disappointment, but Ty only looked at him with wide gray eyes. My bag, Ty said. Where is it? Is it over there? Kit was too stunned to speak. Did Ty remember what had happened? Would it be worse if he did or didn't? My duffel bag, Ty said. There was a definite strain in his voice now. Over there? I need it. The duffel bag was under the second bed. As Kit went to retrieve it, he glanced out at the view.
the crystal spires of the demon towers reaching toward the sky, the water glimmering like ice in the canals, the walls of the city and the fields beyond. He had never been in a place so beautiful or so unreal-looking. He carried the bag over to Ty, who was sitting with his legs dangling over the side of the bed. Ty took the duffel and started to rummage through it. "Do you want me to get Julian?" Kit said. "Not right now," Ty said. Kit had no idea what to do. He'd never in his entire life had so little idea what to do, in fact. Not when he found a golem examining the ice cream in his fridge at 4 a.m. when he was 10. Not when a mermaid had camped out for weeks on his sofa when he was 12 and spent every day eating goldfish crackers. Not even when he'd been attacked by mantid demons. There had been an instinct then, a shadow hunter sense that had kicked in and propelled his body into action. Nothing was propelling him now. He was overwhelmed by the desire to drop down to his knees and grab Ty's hands and hold him the way he had on the rooftop in London when Livy had been hurt. At the same time, he was just as overwhelmed by the voice in his head that told him that would be a terrible idea, that he had no clue what Ty needed right now. Ty was still rustling around in his bag. "He must not remember," Kit thought with rising panic. He must have blanked out the events in the council hall. Kit hadn't been there when Robert and Livy died, but he'd heard enough from Diana to know what Ty must have witnessed. People forgot horrible things sometimes, he knew, their brains simply refusing to process or store what they'd seen. "I'll get Helen," he said finally. "She can tell you what happened."
"I know what happened," Ty said. He had located his phone in the bottom of the bag. The tension left his body. His relief was clear. Kit was baffled. There was no signal anywhere in Idris. The phone would be useless.
"I'm going back to sleep now," Ty said. "There are still drugs in my system. I can feel them."
He didn't sound pleased.
"Should I stay?" Kit said.
Ty tossed the duffel bag onto the floor and laid back on the pillows. He was gripping the phone in his right hand so tightly that his knuckles were white, but otherwise he showed no recognizable signs of distress. He looked up at Kit. His gray eyes were silver in the moonlight, flat as two quarters. Kit couldn't imagine what he was thinking.
"Yes, I'd rather you did," he said. "And go to sleep if you want. I'll be fine."
He closed his eyes. After a long moment, Kit sat down on the bed opposite Ty's, the one that was supposed to be Libby's. He thought of the last time he'd seen her alone, helping her with her necklace before the big council meeting, the way she'd smiled, the color and life in her face. It seemed absolutely impossible that she was gone. Maybe Ty wasn't the one acting oddly at all. Maybe the rest of them, in accepting the fact of her death, were the ones who didn't understand. It felt like 100 miles between Emma's room and his, Julian thought. Like 1,000. He made his way through the halls of the canal house as if he were in a dream. His shoulder burned and ached.
Emma was the only person he had ever desired, and the force of that desire sometimes stunned him. Never more than tonight. He had lost himself in her, in them, for some totality of time. He had felt only his body and the part of his heart that loved and was uninjured. Emma was all the good in him, he thought. All that burned bright. But then the pain and the sense of something wrong, and he had known.
As he hurried toward his room, fear tapped against the outside of his consciousness, howling to be